From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the battle over SNAP and how the disruption of the benefit is hurting Texans.
You're not allowed to just starve 42 million Americans to try to get your the party that you're is disagreeing with you to do what you want. Like, that's inappropriate, it's cruel, and it's unlawful.
And porch pirates and the law.
Texas is toward the top of the list in porch pirate incidents and value of items stolen, and San Antonio and Houston are both in the top eight.
Support for this podcast of Texas Matters comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. By investing in local communities and rewarding policyholders for prioritizing safety, they are building a more resilient Texas. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Food insecurity and hunger have become a very real crisis for families across the state as SNAP payments are caught in the crosswinds of politics and budget gridlock. When elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. It's an old African proverb. It means that when the powerful clash, it's the ordinary people, the powerless, who suffer the consequences. And we're seeing that now with the federal government shutdown stalemate in Washington, D.C., and the resulting non-payment of SNAP. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program supports roughly 3.4 million Texans, including 1.7 million children. Right now, payments that normally land between the 1st and the 15th of the month have been delayed because the federal government remains shut down. A federal judge in Rhode Island ordered the Trump administration to immediately restore full SNAP funding, but President Trump has filed an appeal challenging that order. Here in Texas, food banks are seeing a surge of demand, and community agencies are mobilizing to fill the gap. But they are in no way capable of meeting the needs of so many families in Texas during this time. Bobby Kogan is the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress.
We should back up and we should remind ourselves how we got to where we are. We are in a shutdown, but during a shutdown, there's still kind of this contingency fund for SNAP. There's about $4.6 billion. When the shutdown began, there was about $6 billion in this contingency fund. And the reason that SNAP benefits are not going out right now is that the president chose to illegally not administer them. His own kind of guidance said that he could use them. Then he deleted that guidance and started saying he couldn't do it. Then he was taken to court, and court said, yep, you do have to, in fact, deliver SNAP benefits based on this contingency fund. He started complying, but it kind of, you know, because it came weeks late, that's why a lot of money hasn't gone out. Now a judge says he has to make kind of the benefits whole. He's appealing that one. But basically, we're in a mess, in part because we're in a shutdown, but in part because the president went back on his own guidance on kind of delivering these funds.
So we have to recognize that it's been days, a week, since people have been able to access their SNAP benefits.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, 1 in 8 Americans rely on SNAP. There are food banks that are stretched past their limits. For every one meal that a food bank can deliver, SNAP can deliver about 9, right? Volunteerism is great. You have a civic duty to help where you can, but it is no substitute for SNAP, for what the federal government can do here. There's a lot of evidence, right, that folks on SNAP kind of always have to struggle in that last week or two of the month. The average benefit for SNAP is about $2 per person per meal, right? They're very meager. It's supposed to help. But even the folks on SNAP really struggle to put food on the table. And so by having them be delayed, there's huge, huge, huge harm to the humans that are caught in the middle of this kind of squabble here. But again, I would just reiterate that if the president had followed his own guidance that he released on September 30th, instead of walking it back and then spending weeks not getting ready to send out benefits, we wouldn't be in this, right? They finally, on November 1st, said, okay, fine. We'll begin the process of sending out benefits. And if instead they'd been preparing all month, benefits would be out right now.
Right. We use the term folks on SNAP. I just want to have a clear-eyed view about who are the folks on SNAP, because there have been some, like Senator Tuberville, who have tried to frame this as something that only impacts people who are in the inner city. He's using coded language. But, you know, let's really talk about, like, who is on SNAP. And it is across America. We know that it is generally people who are disabled, elderly, children. These are the people who benefit mostly from SNAP. It is a rural America, has a higher percentage of people on SNAP than in the cities, and that more people who are white, Caucasian, are on SNAP than other demographics. So these are facts.
Yeah, that's precisely right. About 17 million are children. Many folks are disabled, as you say. You're more likely to be on SNAP if you're white than if you're black. It's a lifeline for Americans, right? And for reasons that probably I'm not supposed to say on the air, over time, a stereotype has been created about who uses SNAP. But the truth is that it's just a lot of struggling people who have difficulty putting enough food on the table, and this is a lifeline for them. And there's no reason that these folks need to be hurt, right? There's no reason the kids need to be hurt. There's no reason the people with disabilities need to be hurt. There's no reason the million veterans on SNAP need to be hurt. There's no reason the caretakers need to be hurt. There's no reason the elderly need to be hurt. The only reason this is happening right now is that the president illegally decided to not deliver SNAP benefits. Again, he is now in the process of doing that, and I'm glad that that is happening, right?
You keep using the word illegally, and probably a more precise word would be unlawfully.
Yeah, and to dig into this, so why do I say that he had to do this? When we appropriate money for SNAP, when we provide money for it, we also at the same time create what's called a contingency fund. And it's been incorrectly described as only for responding to natural disasters. But if you read the language, it's really short. It's about a clause, right? It's just a handful of words, and it says there's money that can be used for up to 3 years to help carry out program operations if there's insufficient funding. And that's it. That's what it is. And what is SNAP? SNAP is a benefit program. So program operations are delivering benefits, and then the administration of making that happen. And as I say, the money lasts for 3 years. So there was a pot of money given in 2024 that could still be used. There's a pot of money in 2025 that could still be used. That's why there was initially the $6 billion. SNAP is an entitlement. What does that mean? That means that if you don't get it, you can sue the government, and the government will say, you're right, here you go. Or sports will say, yeah, you're right, here you go. That's what it means. And the same reason, same way that if the federal government just didn't give you your SSI benefits, or they just didn't give you your Social Security, you could sue, you could win. So SNAP's entitlement, there's money to make SNAP happen. And under like kind of budget jurisprudence, if you're entitled to something, you have a pot of money that can make it happen, then it must happen. That was the basis of the court cases, both courts that kind of looked at this said, yep, that's right. You're entitled to it, and there's money to make it happen. So the Trump administration must make it happen. And again, the point that I tried to make a handful of times here, just because I think it's so key, is that on September 30th, the day before we shut down, USDA put out its guidance for what would happen during a shutdown. And they said, okay, well, during a shutdown, we can dig into this contingency fund and use it. But then on October 23rd, they deleted their own guidance and said, never mind, we can't do that. That contradicted their own guidance. That contradicted their guidance from the 2018-2019 shutdown. It contradicts the guidance from every other president's, lapse plan, shutdown plans in history. It was just kind of this needless walk back that ended up hurting 42 million Americans.
And so the point of that is that what's happening right now is not policy, it's politics.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, I think from the president's point of view was, if I can increase the harm and the suffering, then, maybe this will end the shutdown. I get it, but you're not allowed to just starve 42 million Americans to try to get the party that is disagreeing with you to do what you want. Like, that's inappropriate. It's cruel, and it's unlawful.
Bobby Kogan is the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at the Center for American Progress. When enrollment for the Affordable Care Act health care plan opened this month, low-income families accustomed to smaller, non-existent monthly payments were hit with sky-high prices. That's because the tax credits that kept premiums low will expire at the end of the year. Houston Public Media's Bianca Seward reports the impact for Texas will be more severe than anywhere else in the country.
Felicia Suber spent weeks calculating, estimating, and agonizing over what her son's new monthly health care premiums might be when ACA enrollment opened without tax credits.
I knew it was going to happen. I thought it was going to be even worse than it was. It's a lot. It's a lot.
When Suber's son lost his job, she was able to secure him a plan with a tax credit under the ACA that costs just $45 a month. Now, it's nearly $500 a month. An analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation, a health policy and research firm, shows that on average, annual out-of-pocket premiums would more than double. Suber and her son are still weighing their options among the various high premiums.
I haven't quite made the decision yet. We still may just go to a catastrophic plan and just hope for the best.
The credits were introduced in 2021 during the pandemic under the American Rescue Plan Act. The goal was to provide temporary relief for families by helping lower monthly premiums. The cuts were later extended under the Inflation Reduction Act in 2022. Debate over extending the tax credits is at the heart of the current federal government shutdown. Democrats want to see the credits be made permanent before reopening the government. Here's Houston area Democratic Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher on social media.
So many people, this is nearly a million people in our community that rely on these enhanced premium tax credits.
Conservatives are pushing to pass a clean continuing resolution to keep the government funded and end the shutdown before addressing the ACA tax credits. In an appearance on Houston Matters last month, Houston area Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw argued against extending the credits, saying they're too costly.
It was meant for a temporary emergency. They were never meant to be permanent. You make them permanent, you're talking about almost $500 billion in costs over the next 10 years.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates $350 billion would be added to the deficit over the next 9 years if the credits were kept. The office notes it would also insure an additional 3.8 million people. But Crenshaw and other Republicans say the credits don't address the central cause of rising health care costs.
You know, insurance premiums are not going up because the government isn't subsidizing them enough. They're going up because the government subsidizes insurance companies over patients.
Blake Hudson, Vice President of Public Affairs for the Texas Association of Health Plans, agrees, but says,
unfortunately, these loss of tax credits are not coming with any new ideas to really get a handle on healthcare spending. I agree. You know, we need to do something about the broader issue. But in the meantime, people need to be able to afford their healthcare coverage.
If the credits are left to expire, experts point to a cascade of consequences. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, more than 40% of adults who buy their own health insurance would drop their coverage if their premiums doubled. The Commonwealth Fund projects the lack of healthcare funding brought in by the tax credits would cause state economies to lose about $40 billion, and nearly 400,000 jobs would be lost in 2026. The effects in Texas would be especially severe. The state didn't expand Medicaid and is home to the highest number of uninsured citizens. In recent years, Texas has seen the highest increase in ACA enrollments in the country. Hudson warns Texas would be ground zero for the worst impacts of losing the tax credits.
In fact, if you combine Texas and Florida, it's probably about half of everyone that loses insurance. You look at other states like California, little over 100,000 people lose coverage. Well, in Texas, it's tenfold that.
Checking back in with Felicia Suber, she says Texans should prepare now before the higher premiums take effect.
If you have insurance, get into the doctor now. Get stocked up on your blood pressure medicines. Ooh, it's going to be rough for a lot of people.
I'm Bianca Seward in Houston.
Porch pirates is the informal term for people who steal packages that have been delivered and left outside someone's home. Many thefts are caught on doorbell cameras, which help popularize the term even more. Porch piracy is theft, but some states, including Texas, have passed laws making it a specific crime with harsher penalties, especially if the thief steals from multiple homes or from vulnerable individuals. But what can someone do to prevent a porch pirate from stealing your packages? Kirk Evans is the president of U.S. Law Shield.
Texas is toward the top of the list in porch pirate incidents. and value of items stolen, and San Antonio and Houston are both in the top eight. Now, that's probably a factor, you know, a pure number deal. They're both, you know, just very high population cities. But the suburbs tend to create an additional sort of issue when it comes to porch pirates. The incidents per capita are higher in San Antonio and Houston than they are in, say, New York City. And that's more the urban sprawl, the suburbs. People can, you know, drive around patrolling, looking for packages to pick up.
I've seen a lot of videos online showing a porch pirate going towards the view of the camera. You know, we have these doorbell cameras now. And then they grab the package, and then they walk away, and then the package will explode. And a huge, colorful cloud of dust, chaos, follows. I get the impression that these are AI-generated. Have you seen these? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I definitely do, and, you know, it seems very entertaining. I think every person on the world would love to get revenge against the porch pirates. In Texas, those are against the law if they are designed to or known to have a reasonable probability of causing death or serious bodily injury, which, you know, if something got into a person's eye, put out their eye, they lost their vision, that would almost always constitute a serious bodily injury. So not a great idea in Texas unless you're absolutely certain that you're not going to cause death or serious bodily injury.
These videos, like as you say, they're very satisfying and entertaining to watch. They're likely AI generated because they seem to follow a very specific pattern. But they're so well made, it's very difficult to immediately spot them as AI. They're hyper-realistic. And you're saying that this is not a model to follow. People do not have carte blanche to try to injure someone with a trap of some sort, even if they're stealing your package.
Correct. I do not know, you know, if everything worked out perfectly and it was like the videos and everybody laughed, you know, great. I don't know of any, you know, product or design you could make that would explode like that and not have some sort of risk of serious bodily injury, particularly to someone's eyes. If that were to happen in Texas, and actually, even if it doesn't happen, technically, just having the device, you could be charged with a Class A misdemeanor, which you would face up to a year in prison and up to a $4,000 fine.
So what can you do if you catch someone stealing from your porch? What are your rights?
Sure. If you actually catch them in the act, right, the person is there. In Texas, you can use force, but not deadly force. So think of pushing, shoving, grabbing, yelling, maybe even pepper spray or something like that. There are a couple of exceptions for theft in the nighttime or criminal mischief in the nighttime, where you were technically under the statute allowed to use deadly force. But even then, it's not a great idea because you're going to have to convince a jury that it was reasonable to shoot someone over a, you know, $111 Amazon package.
Right. So what should firearms owners be thinking about? I mean, is it self-defense when your property is being stolen?
Yeah, and in Texas, if it's just the property, deadly force is almost never going to be authorized. And a lot of folks get confused if it happens on the porch or on their property. They think, Castle Doctrine. Castle Doctrine does not apply to somebody taking something off of your porch. It is only if they attempt to break in with force, get inside your house or apartment, that type of thing. So Castle Doctrine doesn't apply. Almost never going to be able to use a firearm against a mere porch pirate.
What if I pull my weapon on them and point it at them?
Okay. So the pointing might be a little too far, but in Texas, you are allowed to display a weapon to create apprehension in the other person that you might use it. And that is actually considered in Texas force. but not deadly force. Now, the cases are actually a little ambiguous on once you actually point that firearm against someone. I would highly advise against that. I probably would highly, if it's just a, you know, $100 worth of Amazon packages, I probably would advise against even getting the firearm out in the first place. If you're right and the person runs away, okay, you may be in good shape. If they report you to the police, you may be facing aggravated assault charges, which you're looking at, you know, 10 years in prison.
You think a lot of people are confused about what they can do and what they can't do, particularly when there is this online, you know, these clips that show up that look like you can be really aggressive and violent in protecting your packages?
Oh, definitely. There are a whole bunch of misconceptions out there, particularly surrounding the Castle Doctrine and trespassers. As we talked about earlier, the Castle Doctrine does not help you out whatsoever outside your dwelling if a person is merely stealing property. And then trespassers alone, Texas law does not allow deadly force against a mere trespasser, which, you know, a lot of folks do not know that.
Even if I put up a sign that says no trespassing, don't steal my packages, does that help at all?
No, it certainly is going to be slightly better evidence for you, but that neither of those will help you out if you use deadly force against a porch pirate.
So under what circumstances can a homeowner use a weapon during a robbery or a burglary?
Sure. So if things escalate, so if you confront the person, that person pulls out a gun and threatens you, in that case, you definitely would be allowed to use deadly force under Texas law. If they tried to break in and get into your home with force and unlawfully, you could then use deadly force, and you get a presumption under the Castle Doctrine that was reasonable if they were trying to come into your home with force.
Does the doorbell camera, does that help in those types of circumstances that you're able to alleviate, get away from the my word versus their word?
Sure. That's if you do everything perfectly, that's going to be great. You'll have better evidence than you otherwise would. If it's a completely ambiguous situation, I don't know, it could very well hurt you just as well as help you.
If you're hyper-aggressive, if you're the one that pulls the weapon first, does that make a difference?
Definitely, if you did not have a justification. If you are the only person there with a gun and there's no other legal justification, yes, the initial aggressor actually won't have the protection of the Stand Your Ground laws in Texas.
Where do you see this going? People want to protect their property. It could be medicine that they need in that package, and this is their property, things that they have worked for. So how should people be thinking about this?
Sure. There are a number of other, options. So, if you really, really, if you know it's your kid's Christmas present that they absolutely, the one item they absolutely have to have, you can have that, have that item delivered at a time when you know you'll be home, or Amazon offers a couple other options to their lockers and Amazon delivery spots, things like that. And then, this is ultra boring, but on any of these, no matter how minor, it helps to report the theft, not to get that particular, package back. But if they actually catch these organized rings, Texas has a statute dealing with organized rings of retail theft, where the punishments are actually enhanced. If you can tell this is an organized ring, repeat offenders, a whole bunch of items have been stolen. So if you report these folks, it will increase the penalty as it gets farther down the road.
Kirk Evans is the president of U.S. Law Shield. High-speed police chases can be deadly, and rules and accountability for chases can vary state by state. Texas does not have statewide standards. In fact, only 6 states collect data on chases at all. So what can regulations in Texas look like at the state level, and can they make a difference? KERA's Carolyn Love went to Minnesota to find out.
We'll have 100% control.
Pete Dahl is one of the driving instructors at Dakota County Technical College's Pursuit Course for Law Enforcement in Minnesota. Officers with as little as 1 month or as much as a decade of experience all drive on the winding track. Their cars whoosh in the breeze as they navigate the sharp curves.
You can see how some of them come off that corner and they stay tight, right? They don't use up the whole road.
Dahl says well-trained officers are in control of their emotions and their speed, and that separates them from the suspect they're chasing.
Well, we stay proficient in our firearms because we have to do that perfect when the time comes, right? We have to be perfect when we're driving too, or people get hurt or killed.
State law here requires officers to do 8 hours of continued education on pursuits at least every 5 years. That's on top of what they learn in the academy. Texas does things differently. Their officers don't learn about chases in the academy. That's because there's no statewide regulation on pursuits. It's up to each individual department to come up with their own policy, and they can look very different even in neighboring jurisdictions. Officers in Texas do learn driving techniques in the academy, but they don't do any additional training on it after they get their license. People in Minnesota law enforcement who spoke to KERA say the extra practice behind the wheel is helpful. Derek Rowe is a Minnesota state trooper who patrols the freeways of St. Paul. He's become more cautious with pursuits. A driver he chased early in his career hit another car on the freeway. The uninvolved pregnant driver was hospitalized.
That really made me think there's real risks of doing this and actually hurting someone, so how worth it was it for that one speeder that just didn't want to get a speeding ticket?
Minnesota state troopers have to follow their department's chase policy during pursuits. And every year, all state and local law enforcement agencies have to certify they have a policy in place that meets state standards. Otherwise, they'll face sanctions. Texas law enforcement agencies are required to have a pursuit policy, but the law doesn't go any further than that. Republican State Representative A.J. Lauterbach from Victoria, Texas, told KERA earlier this year statewide standards would be too restrictive.
We're right where we need to be. Each chase is a separate entity. Each chase is handled on its own. Each chase, the facts are different. There's so many factors here that come into chase.
Lauterbach says local entities are better equipped to set standards for their own communities. Others say any broad policy would still need to be flexible.
A lot of the jurisdictions pushback is, one size doesn't fit all.
State Representative Ray Lopez is a Democrat from San Antonio.
And I think that has to be part of the legislation that we craft.
That's similar to what Minnesota does. Captain Brian Cheney from Minnesota State Patrol says the standards are a guideline each department can build on. The guidelines and enhanced training in Minnesota serve a purpose, increasing safety during high-speed police chases. And he says the training's worked. The number of officers who choose to end their own pursuit has gone up. And according to state data, that hasn't led to an increase in crime. Still, Cheney says no chase is without risk.
When you ask me, what's a safe pursuit? I'd say no pursuit is a safe, just not pursuing is the safest.
He says it's up to law enforcement to control their response to protect everyone involved in the chase, something that could be the difference between life and death for the public. I'm Caroline Love in St. Paul, Minnesota.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can download and subscribe to Texas Matters wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.